Guns N' Roses, Welcome to the Jungle. Also known as The Phil Nason Show, it is Tuesday afternoon, February the 12th, 2013, 2 days to Valentine's Day. And as I've been urging you on the entire week, if you forget her Valentine's Day, she'll forget you. You don't want that out there, do you? You know, today we've got a great show. In the middle of this show, Barbara Morrison will be here. She's written an amazing book called Innocence, Confessions of a Welfare Mom, a Welfare Mother. But up first is our old friend, man. He's on the line with me, too. He's from Minnesota, and he's freezing, and it's snowing like crazy. But our friend John Krakowski is here. John, what's up, dude? How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, and I hope everybody else is doing better than we are. I think the East Coast got it worse than we did. We had about a foot of snow yesterday, and the roads are kind of treacherous, so, you know, you got to wish everybody gets home safe. But we're diehard Minnesotans, so, you know, we're kind of used to that.
Yeah, that's right. You would be used to it. Now, how much snow did you get over the weekend?
We got about a foot, and there were some 20, 30-mile-an-hour winds, and we had some rain with it, and southern Minnesota, I guess they even had some lightning. So, you know, it's we get a big mixture.
Yeah, I guess you would, don't you? Yeah, I guess you would. So, now tell me something. You went to the big ice fishing thing. You just sent me a video. How was that? How'd that go?
I should have worn my dumb hat. First time I ever went to this event, it is the largest ice fishing contest in the world. And they drill 20,000 holes on this lake in Brainerd, Minnesota. So it's been going for, it was the 23rd, and they donate, every year they donate $200,000 to charity. And so my first event, they've been, I've always participated somewhat. I do a lot of fishing songs. And they were after me, the radio station that hosts this, been after me for a few years to do a fishing song about this event. So I wasn't going to go to the event. And then I got a friend that's been going 16 years. So he talked me into it. And I thought, okay, I'll go. So I decided to write a song about the event. So we got up there at 8 o'clock in the morning, got on the ice. We drove 100 miles. I'm 100 miles from there. Got on the ice about around 9. We had to walk a half mile. Otherwise, you got to be bussed. They have, I don't know, 100 buses because they get on the average 10,000 people at this event. Anyway, we park closer. There's a couple parking places you can, pay $20-$30 and get to park your car rather than ride the bus. So we did that, but we were on the ice by 9 o'clock. The wind was blowing all about 30 miles an hour and gusting to 40. It was 27 degrees. That wasn't bad. You know, and it is what, 10,000 people coming, you want to pick a spot, you know, check your depths, and it's kind of a fishing thing, you know, you got to go out and check a depth and see where you think might get a fish. Any fish can win up to 100, they have a giveaway 150 prizes, so the first 150 fish get a good prize. So you might, eighth fish might get a $10,000-$12,000 four-wheeler, but the biggest fish gets a brand new Ford or Chevy pickup. Well, let me tell you, the event starts at noon, the contest, and at noon, it was down to about 23 degrees, and the wind started gusting to 50 miles an hour. Had there been a half inch of snow, they wouldn't even, on the lake, there wouldn't have been be able to have the event, there would have been a total whiteout. And people, about 1:30, people started leaving by the hundreds, because the cold, it was just terrible, it was almost glare ice, and we were getting a few snow squalls. And when snow hits you in the face, flakes at 40, 50 miles an hour, it's about like a pin. So would I go again? I'm going to go again. I didn't even get a damn bite, you know, so I can say damn, I hope. But I should have worn my dumb hat. It was crazy out there. I finally left at 3 o'clock, never got a bite all day. A guy wanted a brand new Ford pickup with a 3.5-pound Northern, which is a small Northern. So, but it was a crazy time. And crazy Minnesotans, but we get them. I think people came from all over the United States for this event.
And you performed at that, right?
No, I didn't perform at that. They were playing all my fishing songs on the radio, which they have. It's almost like a city. They have a lot of vendors. You can buy ribs, all kinds of food, augers. People from Brainerd and anybody to do with outdoors are out there as vendors selling stuff and showing their products off. So, but the radio station was, you couldn't hear too far because the speakers didn't go too far in the wind. If you could hear for 300 feet, that was about it. 50-mile-an-hour winds, just almost unbelievable to try to fish in. Would I do, I would never do it again in a 50-mile-an-hour wind, put it that way.
Now, when you said you didn't get a bite, did you get frostbite, though? Because it was cold. 50-mile-an-hour winds on the lake in the winter. That's horrendous, isn't it?
Yeah, I was dressed for it. So, you know, I didn't get cold. But it was, you really had to be dressed right for it. You know, it's kind of a thing. You kind of get used, you know, right now we're at around 20 degrees. Well, that's pretty comfortable for us. That's almost a heat wave.
Yeah, it's not so great here either. It's been raining like crazy, but sounds like you had fun, though.
Yeah, I could have had a better time had it been nice. And since then, I've went to two other small fishing contests. I don't know. Maybe I should give up fishing. I didn't get a bite in any of them. So, yeah. But it's a good cause, and, you know, it's good for the state. The fishing industry in Minnesota here, we got 10,000 lakes, so it's it generates a lot of money. You know, I think it's over $1 billion a year.
Yep, the land of 10,000 lakes, the state of Minnesota. The Gopher State, right?
No, that's Wisconsin. We are, boy, I don't know what you call our state. Minnesota.
All right, Minnesota. Minnesota, the Golden Gophers of Minnesota, right?
Yeah, but yeah, we got the Golden Gophers. I don't think it's called the Gopher State. The point, you know what? That's kind of odd. Maybe my brain ain't thinking.
Well, I don't know. I was just asking you. I was just trying to see what's up. But I'll tell you what. You know, today I saw that the Pope has decided to step down. First time in 600 years. That's something else, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, they said it's health issues. You know, I wonder why they never get a younger Pope in there. I've always wondered why that. Why did he pick a guy, I can't remember how long he's been in, but he had to be in his 70s or, you know, I suppose it's a seniority thing. Whoever gets, it's kind of like being president. They want to move up, enjoy the life of the good life.
I don't know. You know, I think it's that, I think it's more political than anything else. They claim that they're waiting on God to choose the successor to the church and whatever, but, yeah, you know what? At least he knew enough to step aside. A lot of people don't, and no other Pope had. You remember John Paul? He looked like a disaster. And I don't mean to pick on anyone who's Catholic, but you had to look at the guy and say, he's in charge of the church. What is this all about? I mean, what did you think about John Paul, for example?
Well, you know, I don't follow the popes real close, but when you say he was intelligent enough to step down, if you're not going to be effective, that's a good thing. You know what? A lot of our U.S. politicians should maybe step down if they're not effective.
You know, that's not a bad idea. You know, I'm still depressed about our not getting Mickey Mouse elected. I'm really ticked about that because we gave it a shot, didn't we?
Yeah, and that was a good challenge. You know, all the bill, what was it? I think $4 billion they said they spent on the election, and I think it could have changed the outcome of the election. Had one of them said, "Okay, I'll do my campaigning on Facebook to the last month, and I'll donate my $1 billion or $500 million, whatever's left, to the people on the East Coast from Hurricane Sandy." I think it could have been a change in the election.
You know, that's entirely possible. I think that you're right, too. I honestly believe that you're correct. But you know what I've discovered? It's not about the people. It's about the position that they're in. That's what they want. They don't want to serve the people. They want the position. Does that seem like it to you? Am I right or wrong or what?
Yeah, I think it's all about power. In the end, you know, I wish they'd put out something where you could see what every senator and rep was worth the day their net worth was worth the day they took office and what it was worth each year after that. You know, and I know we're going to be talking about welfare a little bit. I think we're going to touch base on that. But I think our government, our politicians actually help contribute to the rising costs of welfare. Boy, I'm going to get in trouble for that, ain't I?
Well, that's okay, because, you know, when you come on the show, you're allowed to get into trouble. So kind of go ahead and explain that, if you can.
Well, I think, you know, it's all our economic situation that drives people to welfare, you know, during the war and poverty and depressions. And that's what sends people. You know, we all have tough times. And I think our government is are responsible for this in some way. Look at the housing market, how they let this mortgage fraud go through. That was all created by our government, taking away restrictions. You know, and they blame the people. Everybody in America wants a piece of the pie. So, you know, if you went out and when a salesman says, buy this house, it's worth $300,000, it'll be worth $500,000 in 3 to 5 years, you know, people are going to jump on that. But our government created a lot of that by letting all the restrictions they took loose and letting these mortgage companies do that. So that created created welfare situations. And what I was looking at on the web, I think they even include from the welfare, I think it's medical, everything like that's included in the welfare. But there's been some, you know, high gas prices contribute to it, high cost of health care. People just can't afford it. And I think it drives a lot of people into poverty. I don't think we'll ever get away from welfare. I think we should stop the fraud. But I think our government could do a lot about that.
Yeah, but they're not interested in that, it doesn't seem. Because, you know, like this interview, and I recorded it yesterday. And it's amazing. You all have to listen to that. It's really be careful when you listen to it because you're going to be shocked. But, you know, one of the things is you're one illness away from poverty in America. How is that possible?
Well, if you look, I think what's an aspirin cost in a hospital now? $50? You know, it's kind of crazy. And I think that's where our government could control things a little more. We need a really good healthcare system. I talked to a healthcare provider, and I said I got the solution to that. And she worked with financing, and I says, why don't we all be eligible to go on Medicare and buy into Medicare? Medicare is running in the red. Well, for instance, if they'd let me buy, my average insurance cost for me and my wife's is $1,200 a month, and that's with a $5,000 deductible. Well, if I could buy into Medicare at $300 a month or something like that, overnight, everybody would go on Medicare. The majority of people would sign up for this and pay their $300 a month. Medicare would be in the black. And in turn, the insurance companies would have to cut their rates. You never see insurance companies cutting their rates. They just keep going up. And that's, I think, what we got to do is control the costs.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, sure. It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah, you can go, I don't think it'd be if a catastrophic illness, you know, you can spend $100,000 a week in a hospital. It's, you know, right now the industry is hurting because a lot of people aren't going in. They don't have insurance. You know, I don't know how financially they're, the doctors are having a little tougher time. And then you got the lawsuits and everything else, you know, but there's different opinions on that too, on the lawsuits, on these multi-million dollar for these doctors that screw up, you know, and I think when they take off the wrong limb, they are open to a lawsuit. But the frivolous ones, you know, I was watching, anytime you turn on the TV late night, you'll see, have you had this implant? Call us, all the ambulance chasers, you know, they say you're entitled to money back, refund. So it's a frivolous end. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, it never seems to end. We don't have that here in Greece, thankfully. But I do remember those ads, the chasers are after you. If you've been in a car accident, if you suffer whiplash, call 1-800-WHATEVER. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, whatever, I get it. You know, I understand that it's a Sue Happy world. But I got to tell you, doctors do have to pay a hefty premium for malpractice because they get sued over some silly things too, though. But this universal health care, why is it that they will not do that? We hear all this nonsense, especially from people like Bill Clinton. We heard it a lot. And then we hear it from Obama quite a bit about taking care of the people, making sure everyone has affordable health care insurance. Has that ever happened in our lifetime?
Well, I don't think it's getting worse all the time where we can't afford it. And you've got to come up with some program. They got to start somewhere, you know, but finding people because they can't afford insurance, you know, that's the wrong way to go. they got to make it affordable. And what they're doing, you know, there's too many lobbyists. It's just like, if you want to know where your politician, who he's going to work for, go see who donates to his campaign fund. Follow the money. They're not working for the people. They're public servants. They've all forgot who they work for. And that's the worst thing. You know, it's all, I think everything revolves around the dollar. How can I make money at it?
Makes sense to me. But doesn't make sense, but that's a good explanation for it. And there's really, what are you going to do? As long as it's a money-hungry society that we live in, what are you going to do? You know, and that's the problem that we have, John, is that people, you know, we talked about this before. You know, I understand ideas and this and that, but when you watch a campaign, you don't see people attacking ideas. You see them attacking each other. And that's a big turnoff, isn't it? And that's probably has a lot to do with why people don't have affordable health care. Because these guys, it's not about getting along, but they don't even respect each other enough to just leave each other alone and deal with the ideas. Do you see the same thing?
Yeah, they don't. It boils down. Everything boils down to the dollar. We put a dollar ahead of every aspect in life itself. We put a dollar value on it. And I think that's the main thing. Everybody looks at the dollar. If you start reading about welfare, there's a lot of good things welfare does. You know, everybody gets out and down on their luck. Look at it after the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl years. People did need to help. And I think we're a hell of a society if we don't help our own, especially when foreign aid. Look at foreign aid. That's welfare. You don't see them cutting that. I know they're after big cuts here, but I think... you know, I really think they need to promote bringing jobs back to America. It's not rocket science. If you quit buying from Minnesota, Minnesota goes broke. If you quit buying from the United States goes broke. And that has a big effect on our economy and on welfare. And that's pretty much what we've done. We need to bring back all of our industry that we had in the United States. We have to be healthier here at home before we can help all the other countries.
That's well said. You know what? We're going to take a break. And when we return, John, Barbara Morrison will be here to discuss her memoir, Innocent, Confessions of a Welfare Mother. And we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Phil Nason Show on these amazing affiliates. And we'll be right back.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show. Been dreaming of that Greek vacation? Well, if you have, then you might want to check out the folks at the Aridi Grand Hotel, located in beautiful Corfu, Greece. Come experience world-class cuisine as well as the hospitality that Greece is legendary for at the Aridi Grand Hotel. You can find them at aridihotel.com or email them at reservations@aridihotel.com. This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit PhilNasons.com.
Welcome back on the Tuesday, February the 12th, 2013 edition of the Phil Nason Show. And remember, please remember that Valentine's is 2 days away. And believe me, guys, if you forget, she never will. So don't forget. And I'll tell you what, like most young ladies, my next guest finished college, fell in love, got married, and began raising a family. What happened next is a story she describes in her amazing memoir, Innocent, Confessions of a Welfare Mother. Please welcome Ms. Barbara Morrison to the Phil Nason Show. Barbara, welcome. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Thank you for having me, Phil.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You're a brave lady. I tell everyone that comes on the show, I said, and you've actually listened to it before you said you would. You're very brave. So I have to ask you right off the bat, how did a college graduate from a middle-class home find herself in the predicament that I just described?
Well, it was pretty simple, actually. My marriage ended, and my husband was not willing to pay child support. And so without child support, at the time, I didn't have a job. I didn't have any savings. I was pregnant with my second child. My parents did not allow me to come home. And so I had nowhere to turn except to the welfare office.
Now, what about your family? Because you did come from a two-parent home, middle class, and from what you described in the book, it was, you had some different ideas about how family should be, but you were technically a very good family, correct?
That's correct, yes. One of the things that I tried to emphasize in the book is that it was during the 70s, and the generation gap was quite large then. As those of us of a certain age remember, my parents were very conservative and were horrified by the younger generation. And so that contributed to the problem. But the main thing was that I was one of the oldest, and they didn't want me coming home with babies. They didn't want me to influence my younger siblings.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I grew up in that same, right in that same generation. So I can relate to that, and so can a lot of our listeners. Now, you find yourself in this predicament. Your husband, your marriage broke up or failed, whatever happened. And you can read the book, by the way, and I suggest you all do. See, here you are. You're with your oldest son, Jeremy, correct?
Correct. He was a little over 1 year old.
And you went, I have to go and do something. And for you, coming from that middle-class home, having that education, always having worked, how difficult was that for you?
Well, my pride definitely took a blow. I had not been raised to think that I would end up on welfare. But I was lucky enough to have a friend, Jill, who was on welfare herself. So it was not an entirely foreign concept to me. And I was extremely grateful to have that safety net to fall back on.
Yeah, you adequately describe that situation in the book. It's amazing. When you first met Jill, though, you were not on welfare. And Jill, in this book, you sort of chronicle some of the other friends of yours who found themselves in similar situations and circumstances. You did a great job with that, by the way. But Jill is the one that struck me as the most unlikely to wind up on welfare. When you met her, what was your first reaction?
Well, she too had graduated from the same college I had, although a few years earlier. But my first reaction was not that she was college educated on welfare. My first reaction was, wait, she's Caucasian. She's white. I had grown up in Baltimore where poverty, welfare was so tied into race, and so it was a surprise to me, naive and young as I was, to realize that, in fact, the largest percentage of people on welfare are white and were white then.
Yeah, that's often the most common stereotype that I find, that these are teenage African-American baby machines, correct?
Correct.
And that's
the reason I wrote the book, was to say that stereotype is not necessarily true.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did a great job with that. Now, you had the second child. Your son is, I mean, obviously your sons are grown up now.
Yes.
And you've got two of them.
Correct.
And then you had a big blow. You lost Celia. What happened there?
My dear little car. It was a little neon green Volkswagen with many holes in it. It was rusted out, but it ran. It was horrible, a horrible blow to me because I couldn't afford to get another car. I didn't have the money for a car. And, you know, transportation is one of those hidden factors that keep people in poverty. You have to have transportation, reliable transportation, to hold down a job. And, of course, I was still a long way from getting a job, but also sort of psychologically, it was a blow to me because I always had this fantasy that I could just get in the car and drive until my money gave out and get away that way. Unrealistic, it would never happen, but still, it was hard to lose that one little sense of freedom that I had.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. And you bring up the fact that one of the things that keep people in poverty is the lack of transportation. The other thing that I discovered in your book was also the lack of proper clothing to go on job interviews, go to school. Did you find that was also a difficult situation?
Oh, yes. I didn't buy any clothes for years. I just kept patching what I had. It was really an enlightenment to me to realize that there were just so many things that were a part of poverty that kept you there.
Yeah, it was an incredible journey. We're here with Barbara Morrison. She's the author of the book Innocent. And I have to tell you, Confessions of a Welfare Mother. And I have to tell you, this book left me spellbound. It was incredible. One of the things that I saw that kind of became a turning point for you, if I could go that far, was the Muddy River Morris Group. What was that all about? And how did that help you begin to make a transition from where you were to where you are now?
Well, Morris dancing is a traditional dance from England. It's like Irish step dancing you might see in river dance, except it's an English tradition. New England is a real hotbed of traditional dancing, contra dancing and square dancing. And there were some people doing this Morris dancing as well. And I kind of fell into that, met them and started dancing with this group. And it was wonderful because, I started because I thought, well, I can get exercise and socialize at the same time and not have to pay any money. I also initially hoped that because we danced out on the street and busked, you know, past the hat, that we might actually make some money. But my cohorts who were wealthy young ladies were embarrassed to pass the hat. So we didn't do that very often. But even more psychologically, it meant that I was stepping out of my environment of welfare mothers and associating with people who were working and who believed that, of course, I would work as soon as I could.
That's the whole point I got from the book. And that's the thing that I want to ask you, Barbara. What is the greatest misconception that people have regarding families on assistance? Because you talked about things in your book where people would see the stamps that you were handing out, the food stamps, and they would look in your cart. I mean, what was the big misconception? What are some of them?
Oh, there's so many. I had one person say to me after reading the book, wow, I didn't realize welfare mothers actually loved their children. I thought they just had more babies to get a bigger check. But the biggest misconception, I think, is that many people believe that folks on welfare are there because they want to be. They're lazy, they don't want to work, and this is a way for them to sit around on their bums all day. And that is so far from the truth. My friend Jill called it a choiceless choice. That is, we had no other choice but to go on welfare. It was that or starve to death.
Yeah, that's for sure. Do you remember the days of government cheese?
Oh, yes.
I was telling my friends here in Greece, I said, you have no idea what this was all about. You could put that brick in the oven and bake it and it wouldn't melt. Do you remember that?
Right, and the canned meat and the flour with worms in it. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the canned meat. It was that black and white generic can, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy. See, this book kind of took me back. You know, I grew up with less than humble means too. I understand these things. And I'll tell you this, if you had any advice that you could give to other young ladies that find themselves in a similar situation as yours, what would you tell them?
I would tell them, don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to apply for the assistance that you as a citizen are entitled to. And then use it. Use every resource that's offered to you to plan a way out. I tried to show other people in my book, as you mentioned, some of my other friends and their situations. And in particular, I showed one person who was afraid to go on welfare and just the suffering that came from that.
Yeah, that was Gloria, right?
Correct.
See, I did read your book.
You certainly did.
See, some of the writers that come on here and they understand if they give me a book on Monday and I bring them on Wednesday, there's a very good chance I skimmed it, but I really don't. I try to read. Okay, I ask every author that comes on the show. And folks, on Sunday, Barbara has kindly agreed to join me. Well, we haven't recorded it yet. We'll see how this interview goes. She might hang up the phone and never talk to me again. But she'll be a guest on the Writers Showcase podcast, and we'll go in more in depth than we were able to do today. But Barbara, I ask every author who comes on the show to give us three reasons why we should buy your book, Innocent, Confessions of a Welfare Mother. Why should we buy the book?
Well, first off, it's a good read. People tell me they stay up all night to finish it, so be warned. The second reason is that you'll learn about a world that I hope is foreign to you and maybe open your mind a little bit to what life is like for people in that world. And the third reason is you'll meet some memorable characters and share in our journey.
Those are good answers. Absolutely. I can give you a whole bunch more. In fact, I will.
Okay.
Not right now. It'll be on my review of the book. You'll find it on the philnasons.com blog. It'll be right there. And goodness gracious, this is a great book. You are a very strong young lady, ma'am. It's nice to meet you.
Well, thank you. But really, I'm no stronger than all the other women that I knew during that time period. And all women on poverty, everybody in poverty, you have to be strong to survive.
And that's the other thing I would say. She's very humble, too. Now, what's next for you, Barbara? When you come on the show, you're going to talk about?
I'm working on a novel currently, and I'm also teaching a lot of writing workshops.
Well, we're looking forward to having you back, and we wish you all the best with this brand new book of yours, this amazing book, Innocent, Confessions of a Welfare Mother. Barbara, thank you so much for taking the time to appear with us.
Thank you, Phil.
All right, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Phil Nascent Show on these amazing affiliates.
Sports Channels, Ohio Sports Radio Network, TalkSuperStation.com.
And we'll be right back.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show. Been dreaming of that Greek vacation? Well, if you have, then you might want to check out the folks at the Aridi Grand Hotel, located in beautiful Corfu, Greece. Come experience world-class cuisine as well as the hospitality that Greece is legendary for at the Aridi Grand Hotel. You can find them at aridihotel.com or email them at reservations at ArreedyHotel.com. This Week in Tennis is a weekly tennis program covering all aspects of professional tennis. The most controversial tennis show anywhere deals with issues no one seems to want to touch. For music and hard-hitting commentary, please visit PhilNasons.com. Hi, this is Phil Nasons from The Phil Nasons Show and This Week in Tennis. When I'm looking for sports information, my first stop, as well as yours should be, sports-kings.com. Great information, scores, highlights, and exceptional commentary. You can find it all there at sports-kings.com. And we are back. What a great interview, huh? On this Tuesday afternoon, February the 12th. What a great interview with a great lady. And on the line with me once again, helping me out here today, is my friend John Kurkoski. John, we talk about your music a lot around here, but we never ever actually got into how you got into music. I don't remember us doing that. So you want to fill us in on how you got into music?
Boy, I started that a long time ago. You know, I grew up in the 60s when cars were cars, boys were boys, and gay men being happy. You know, that's not that. You know, gay had a whole different meaning back when I grew up, when we said we had a gay old time. That means we had just had a good time. You know, but the music stuck with us, and it's still the 60s and 70s. It's just... it's lasting forever, especially with the baby boomers. I suppose when we're all gone, they'll quit playing it. But I started stumbling around just writing. You know, I did a few poems, and then I took a grabbed the guitar and took a few lessons and started putzing. I enjoy just writing. I enjoy writing, and, you know, I've never chased it too far. I never wanted to really be in a band and play the road. I always said, everybody asked me to start a band, and I... you know, didn't want to play the bar scene because when I went to the bar, after a couple hours, I usually couldn't talk too good. So that wasn't a good place for me. But I've enjoyed music and I still enjoy it. I still, I don't do them. Sometimes I do 3 songs a year, sometimes 5 or 7. I'm actually going in and doing a couple more fishing songs. But I enjoy all types of music. You know, it's been a fun thing for me. And it's about leaving something behind at this time of my age.
Well, you definitely left the catalog behind, haven't you?
Yeah, you know, I do some gospel. I've done a Christmas song. I think you had that on your show. And and fishing songs and just some country rock songs. You know, music industry, it's changed a lot, you know. And it's real, hard to get into. And if you want to play on the road, you know, I have a friend that played on a lot of my songs. He played for the famous Johnny Lang. From North Dakota, and he toured the world with him for 8.5 years. He's playing on quite a few of my fishing songs, and you know, the lifestyle gets a little tough. You don't see too many bands like the Rolling Stones, you know. It's a lot of work. I don't know, those guys need to be rewarded. That's a lot of work when you go on tour, and just a lot of work. I'm not a entertainer per se, as I wouldn't want to be on stage that much.
That's fair enough. Now, when you were coming up and you decided that you liked music enough to kind of, you know, at least write and play the guitar a little bit, who were your early influences? What bands and groups and singers did you groove to back in the day?
Well, the Beatles and Dion and the Belmonts, just all the old bands, the Beach Boys. It was just a great time. You know, that's when our economy was going good, political system was working better, so the country was moving along real well. It was a great time for the economic boom through the 60s, you know, especially after the war in the 50s, which I wasn't around. In the 40s, but I was born in the 50s. The country was moving at a high rate of pace. We're investing in America. So it was all the bands were, boy, whether they were from overseas or United States, you know. I guess I was, I love the 60s music, the old rock and roll. James Brown, you know, just many of them, Elvis.
Yeah, gotcha. Now, the reason I asked is because I didn't mean to date you, but I wanted to ask you something. When did you see America change? Because you mentioned before, you said the 60s and early 70s, things were doing really well. What was the turning point that you noticed when things began to change from the America that you knew growing up?
Well, I think that's the welfare wasn't as bad then in the 60s because our government worked for us. And I think, and we were producing, our industry, you know, was just booming in the United States. We made the auto industry and the equipment, everything we did, our industry was booming. And that makes a healthy country and keeps people off welfare. So I think that's when everything started back there. I think government got too big, and as we've watched over the last few elections, we've seen the poverty level come up as donations and the costs of billions of dollars into election. Money has moved too much into government, you know. It's all about a dollar. You look at I was told that the gas didn't hit the stock market till in the mid 70s, pull it back out of the stock market. You know, I think that has a big effect on our economy and welfare and everything else. I don't know if that's true, but at some point it had to hit the stock market. I think that's when our government quit working. It got, it's all about the dollar. And the dollar leads, swayed opinions for our politicians.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's when kind of the things, you know, I grew up, I was starting to really figure out what was happening. I was only 7 or 8, but after the Vietnam War, it seemed like everything changed. It seemed like our country became this country that didn't pull together. You know, they didn't support the kids who were drafted and forced to go to Vietnam, whether it was a popular military action, war, whatever. You noticed that it was a different type of country. Am I too far off there?
No, I think if you look back, even then, they said it was a political war. We had a lot of protesters then because it was a political war. And I think Iraq was a oil-oriented war, you know. I think that was more about oil than anything. Terrorism, Saddam was a bad man, but I don't think he didn't have nothing to do with 9/11. That's pretty much a proven fact, you know, but I think that's where the money and everything changes and changes views on our government. I think our government has so much influence on our country as a whole and how economically it does, and no one believes in our politicians anymore, and I think that's a big downfall of our whole country. They have forgot to be public servants and do what's best for our country instead of what's best for their pocketbook.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think that you're right. Now, we came up in our day, you know, we actually saw like welfare work. You know, they didn't make people feel like scumbags because they were down on their luck. You know, one of the misconceptions that we heard Barbara say earlier was that, you know, most people think it's just 15 is a teenage African-American baby machines who are on welfare or who are on assistance. But Barbara says that's not true. It's mainly they're white people. But the stigma attached to needing help, what I don't understand, John, maybe you can help me out with, we're a country who goes out of our way to help every Tom, Dick, and Harry we can. But yet, we make these people who need help feel like lepers. Does that make sense?
No, and I think we all go through that. We don't make these other countries, though. What, PAC sending them how many billion a year? We don't make them feel like scumbags, do we? You know, I think we need the welfare system here. You know, is there fraud in it? Yeah, but it's gotten out of control and too big. And there's a lot of people making money off the welfare system. I think, got to be careful who I say, you know, names. But I think there's dollars in it for people and in the wrong way. So, and I think they need to reform it, you know, just like the speaking English. What do they say? It costs billions of dollars a year for translators. Gee, why don't this country just change and make English our standard language? Just look at the money we save there.
You know, that's not a bad point.
You know, I think there's several things we could do. And even, I know we were going to talk a little bit about guns and, you know, the whole thing with our economy and everything has a lot to do with that. And maybe this is a good time to start, you know, with our politicians, because boy, they're really going after this gun thing. This is not a good subject, especially when we go into, got to worry about schools. How sad that we have to even be in a discussion to try to solve the problems of stopping massive killings in our schools, which has brought on this whole thing.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that some of these guys are using it as a soapbox rather than as a statement. You know, because here's the thing. You know, these guys, they shout down folks who offer opinions regarding the Second Amendment, yet they hide behind the First Amendment. And it doesn't make sense. You know, the whole issue is this. That young fellow who shot up those kids in Newtown, and that was a horrendous thing, by the way, he would have been able to do that anyway. You know, this kid didn't come, John, from a poor background. You know, they were talking on Piers Morgan about funding more psychiatrists. This kid's family was loaded. I mean, the father was paying over $500,000 a year in child support. That's a heck of a lot of loot. So it's not money that did this. It's a gun, or the fact that this mother grabbed or bought what she wanted to buy, what she was legally able to purchase. It's about a troubled kid who got pissed off and decided to take his pity party out on the world. And it's sad that these folks who want to take away other folks' rights point to that deranged individual as an example.
Well, yeah, because that's not going to solve the problem. Guns, this isn't a problem with the guns. You can take a shotgun, one of the worst weapons there is. You can put double odd buck in it. One shot can kill or hurt several people. I was reading on the internet, and I guess it's a bad thing to publicize. You know, when they show this Columbine school shooting, it just seems like once they publicize that, all these kids get pissed off and go berserk, and there's no deterrent for them. You know, I don't know what's going on, but it's not the guns. We had an incident here in the Midwest where a guy was going through problems with his wife, and he slashed three of his daughter's throats. You know, so what are they going to do? Take away the 10-inch knives or the 5-inch knives? That's not going to solve the problem. It has very little to do with the guns, because you aren't going to. I hunt, and I'm a sportsman, so it's not about the gun. An assault weapon, a shotgun can do just as much damage. So I don't think anybody wants to get into this, the politicians, because they don't have the answer for it. And I don't think they can screen everybody. You can be a perfect person for 40 years and go through a divorce, and it can affect you mentally and with depression, and you can snap. We all have our breaking points. It's how to stop it. But the big thing is the schools now. And I think the biggest deterrent is to have armed security. That's the biggest deterrent on a armored car. You know, they're armored, and you know there's armed security guards inside. I think the best thing for our schools, I would never want to see the teachers armed. I think the best thing is put an armed security guard in each school. It's sad that we have to do this, but at some point, you know, if they don't want to change their society, but that has, I think a lot of this has to do with our economy and everything. You know, what causes all this stuff, the devastation our country's going through with the violence and everything. I think a lot of it has to do with our economy, and maybe they're all looking at the wrong thing to solve this. I think you got to bring back these jobs, get the people working, create a better environment, and maybe you'll do more that way. And then you still have to solve a problem with the kids in schools. Boy, how sad that we have to put an armed guard in our schools, though.
Yeah, how sad that we have to have metal detectors in there to protect the teachers from the kid, the gang kids who carry guns too, or the kids who are being bullied. So many issues involved in this gun battle, John. I tell you that right now, but we've run out of time, my friend.
Hey, but I had a great time.
I always have a great time with you on the show, dude.
Yeah, and I hope you found your cat. I was going to say, I hope you found your pussy, but...
Okay, all right, we're going to quickly run through this real quick. I'm the tennis pro at a very famous resort in Corfu, Greece. This winter, they decided to close it due to economic constraints, but the owner let me stay here because he still wants me here. I still have a successful thing. And more importantly, he asked me, he goes, I want you to do your radio show. They gave me a great ADSL line to do it and a room to do it. And John and I were on the phone one night, and I said, I have to go chase the cat, because unfortunately someone left the door open and there was a cat in the building and I had to go chase it. And yes, my friend, I did catch it.
Well, that's, you did a good thing. Anyway.
See? There you go. Anyway, John, thank you so much for appearing. There'll be a link to John's website in the show notes. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. Tomorrow, Andy Flint will be here. We'll be talking fantasy basketball, NBA basketball news, and all kinds of things, NBA hoops. On Thursday, Jamie and Smith from the Sports Goons will be here. That's Valentine's Day, too. Well, we're just going to have a lot of fun that day. We're going to bring in the Facebook Fugazi thread, and we're going to have a lot of fun with that. And on Friday, we'll be talking baseball with all the guys. Until then, and I want to thank Barbara Morrison and John Krakowski for being on the program. Until then, y'all take care of yourselves. Be good. Be kind to one another. And most importantly, thank you for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And I thank you.